KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201 DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Congo's foreign minister in the U.S. for talks as Rwandan-backed rebels advance. Then how the fight over National Science Foundation grants affects the scientists who are doing the work.
It's very heartbreaking. I have spent years of my life to get to this point, and it's very heartbreaking to know that it's in limbo like this.
Also, Tamara Keith on lights, cameras, action. The Trump Show returns to the White House briefing room. Allie Smith's new novel on a near future with people rounded off as unverifiables. And the musicians who made Samande back making music. First, our newscast. It's Saturday, February 1, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Hamas militants released three men today who had been held hostage in Gaza since October of 2023. Among them was an American Israeli. Here's how it sounded where people had gathered in Hostages Square in Tel Aviv to watch when Keith Siegel was released. His wife had been released in the first round of hostage releases in 2023. In exchange, Israel released 183 Palestinians who had been detained in Israel. Venezuela freed six Americans yesterday who had been detained there. The release came after President Nicolas Maduro met with Richard Grenell, the Trump administration's envoy for special missions. Grenell posted a picture of him and the six men getting off a plane saying, "We are gone." Several Western nations, including the U.S., do not recognize Maduro's claim that he won last year's election. Secretary of State Marco Rubio leaves today on his first overseas trip as the nation's top diplomat, and he's staying in his hemisphere with a focus on migration, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Secretary Rubio is making this region a priority, according to U.S. Special Envoy for the Western Hemisphere, Mauricio Clavercaron.
From migration to security to commerce, there's no other region in the world that affects individual American lives more on a daily basis than the Western Hemisphere.
His first stop is Panama, where the president says he's ready to talk to Rubio about trade and migration, just not control over the Panama Canal. That's something President Trump has set his sights on. Rubio has raised concerns about Chinese companies there, and he's planning to visit the canal on Sunday. He'll also travel to El Salvador, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and the Dominican Republic. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Officials in Philadelphia confirm everyone on board a plane was killed in last night's crash. At least six people on the ground were hospitalized as flames spread through a heavily populated neighborhood. From member station WHYY, Emily Neal reports.
A pediatric patient, her mother, and four other passengers were killed when the medical jet came down and exploded in northeast Philadelphia just a minute into its flight, city officials say. According to the Federal Aviation Administration, the flight was headed to Tijuana, Mexico, with a planned stop in Missouri. The city says many people on the ground were injured on streets and in parking lots, cars, and homes. An investigation into the crash is ongoing. For NPR News, I'm Emily Neal in Philadelphia.
Fire officials in California report two major wildfires that began January 7th are now 100% contained. Between them, the Palisades Fire and the Eaton Fire had burned more than 37,000 acres in Los Angeles County. This is NPR News. Russia launched a barrage of drones and missiles at Ukrainian cities and towns today. Ukrainian officials say at least eight people were killed. This month, Russia's war against Ukraine approaches the three-year mark. Canadians are bracing for 25% tariffs on most products promised to go into effect today by President Trump. As Dan Karpachuk reports, the tariffs could mean higher prices for U.S. consumers and consequences for Canada.
There would be significant implications for major industries such as the automotive sector in Canada. With many Canadian products becoming more expensive, American consumers will likely avoid buying them. Canada has promised to retaliate, imposing taxes on American products such as orange juice and wine and spirits. Canadian officials say in retaliation, all options are on the table, including energy. The U.S. imports well over $100 billion a year from Canada in this sector. It all comes as the Canadian dollar has already dropped against the U.S. dollar, and economists fear a potential prolonged tariff war would mean higher prices and job losses and would likely push Canada into a recession. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
The Teamsters Union said today it's reached a tentative agreement with Costco on a new contract. The Teamsters represent about 18,000 workers in six states. They had voted overwhelmingly to go on strike if there wasn't a new deal when the old contract expired at midnight last night. The terms of the proposed new contract have not yet been released. It must be ratified by union members. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Rebels backed by Rwanda pushed deeper into the Democratic Republic of Congo this week. The M23 fighters have encircled the border city of Goma and have killed more than a dozen UN peacekeepers and sent hundreds of thousands of people fleeing. But aid workers say there is no safe place to run. The DRC's foreign minister is in Washington, D.C., where U.S. officials have condemned Rwanda for the advance of the rebels. Teresa Kayikwamba Wagner is the Congolese Minister of Foreign Affairs. She joins us now. Foreign Minister, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What's the humanitarian situation like where the fighting's going on right now?
The humanitarian situation in Goma and around Goma is dire and catastrophic. In the past days, during which the Rwandan Defense Forces, so the army of Rwanda, launched an assault against the city of Goma, they did so by knowingly cutting access routes as well as shutting down the airport and all capacity to fly over Goma. So this has had a dramatic repercussion on an already extremely tense humanitarian situation. And it is also very difficult, not just for the civilian population, but also for humanitarians to do their work accordingly, to provide assistance, and also to operate health centers where wounded can be taken care of.
Foreign Minister Wagner, what evidence is there, to your mind, that Rwanda sponsors these rebels?
The first evidence is the one that we have from our countrymen and countrywomen who are in Goma and who are telling us that Rwandan troops have marched in on our sovereign territory. The second evidence is the report of the United Nations group of experts that has already, a few weeks ago, established the presence, the increased presence of Rwandan troops in the DRC, over 4,000 troops, according to the UN. There is only one voice claiming that Rwanda is not present, and that is Rwanda alone. The rest of the world knows that they are there, they are killing, they are looting, they are raping, and they are maiming.
You are in Washington, D.C., and have spoken, I gather, to members of the administration. What do they say to you?
We are very pleased that despite the fact that there are a lot of pressing domestic issues, there is an ongoing transition in the United States with an incoming administration. We're very satisfied by the fact that the USA has remained consistent in its stance. I want to remind us that the USA were the first country in the Security Council to denounce the presence of Rwandan troops in the DRC. And we welcome the fact that they have remained as committed and as critical of this clear attempt to destabilize not only the DRC, but the entire region. Of course, We welcome the condemnation. We welcome the fact that we are acting in a context of greater transparency, because that means greater accountability. But we continue to push for firm action. What we see and what we have seen for the past years is that Kigali and President Kagame have no respect for the words and for the threats of the international community. It is high time that we now move on to actions and to stop the spread of this orchestrated violence.
As we speak, M23, the rebel group, has threatened to march on Kinshasa, Congo's capital. What would that mean for the region? How concerned are you about this?
Well, it would mean that the region would have gone back 30 years in time. And this is the threat. Again, it is the threat to all investments that have been made in terms of improved governance, stability, regional integration. It would mean that we would fall back in the very, very dark times of armed groups backed by countries such as Rwanda, as is the case right now, that topple legitimate governments and that topple the rules-based order. It would mean that all of a sudden, despite the efforts that have been made and the immense human sacrifices, we would be back in a context where political decision-making and access to power is decided by the barrel of the gun.
Teresa Kikwamba Wagner is the Congolese Minister of Foreign Affairs, speaking from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us, Foreign Minister.
Thank you.
The National Science Foundation stopped paying out grant money this week, freezing funds to scientists who'd already been awarded money and others in the pipeline. The unprecedented move comes as the NSF works to comply with the Trump administration's executive actions, especially those that target DEI efforts. Yesterday, a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order directing the NSF and other federal agencies to essentially unfreeze those funds and gave the government until Monday to inform grantees. Here's a report now from two NPR correspondents, Andrea Hsu and Jonathan Lambert.
The Trump executive order aiming to end diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts is a particular problem for NSF. That's because they're congressionally mandated to weigh how their grants boost the participation of underrepresented groups in science. It's literally a big part of one of the two criteria for every grant approval in any field. And now Trump is effectively saying that they can't do that. Julia Van Etten is a postdoctoral researcher at Rutgers University. She studies how DNA sharing among microbes shapes their evolution.
This NSF award I got, not a lot of people get this award. I was really honored to get it. I was really excited to work on this project.
And that grant pays her salary. On Tuesday, she was expecting a paycheck, but that paycheck was canceled by the NSF.
I literally just can't pay my bills. And, you know, I'm very, like, smart with my money, but scientists at this career stage are not paid that well. So we all kind of live somewhat paycheck to paycheck. So, like, I was unable to pay my bills, and I will be unable to pay my bills this month if they don't resolve this soon.
Van Etten's paycheck was canceled as part of a total freeze that started this past week. They stopped reviewing new grants and paying out existing ones. The agency, which has a budget of about $9 billion, funds a wide range of science, from astrophysics to zoology. All that funding was paused.
We've been given no communication from the NSF other than emails that all of our fund dispersal is canceled. So, like, we're under the impression that we're supposed to be working without pay right now.
In Atlanta, India Jackson is also in a bind. She's a physicist who studies events that happen on the surface of the sun, things like solar flares and solar winds that can cause problems for satellites, for radio communications, and for our power grid.
I do research to try to predict when those events will happen so that we could try to prepare for those things. I mean, because we can't stop it.
Jackson has always wanted to do research to benefit the public. She's held several internships at NASA. She always keeps in mind that this is taxpayer money. She's grateful Americans pay those taxes.
So that I can do the science that I'm doing, so that I can try to protect them.
She was just a couple final steps away from receiving her own postdoctoral fellowship from the NSF to further that research. But now, even though she's in the system as recommended, her future as a government-funded scientist is on hold. For how long, she has no clue.
It's very heartbreaking. I have spent years of my life to get to this point, and it's very heartbreaking to know that it's in limbo like this.
Last fall, she was teaching math and computer science in adjunct positions, including at HBCUs around Atlanta. But the terms of her NSF fellowship would not have allowed her to continue those jobs. And because things looked on track for her to start her postdoc in February, she quit before the semester began. She was a little concerned that the turnover in administration might delay her start, but she never imagined it would come to this.
To be honest, I really didn't think that it would go this way. I didn't really realize how closely tied in scientific research, how closely that is tied in to politics.
It's unclear how long the funding pause will last, though a court order was issued Friday for NSF and other agencies to unfreeze frozen funds. The agency says it's reviewing all of its grants to see how they comply with Trump's orders. Here's Julia Van Etten, the Rutgers scientist, again.
I know this has only been a few days, but I do think that this isn't going to stop science, but it's stopping like American science. Like if my work, like genome biology moves at a very quick pace, and if my work is delayed for like months, for example, someone in another country is going to publish on something very similar.
That's especially frustrating for Van Etten, given how she felt when she first got this grant.
I felt like that was the government of that time giving me some sort of vote of confidence that my work was important and that it was good for me to accomplish this work. And now I feel the opposite.
NSF has been around for about 75 years. And in this history, it's received broad bipartisan support. But the flurry of action targeting specific kinds of science and scientists during just the first weeks of the Trump administration has many researchers extremely concerned about the next 4 years. I'm Jonathan Lambert.
And I'm Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Hamas released three hostages today who had been held captive since militants attacked Israel in October of 2023. Among them was an Israeli-American. In exchange, Israel released 183 Palestinians who had been detained in Israel. Marco Rubio leaves today for Central America on his first trip as Secretary of State. His first stop is Panama, where he's expected to deliver the message that the U.S. wants to reclaim control over the Panama Canal. And the Democratic National Committee holds its winter meeting today to select its new leaders to guide the party through a second Trump presidency with an eye to the midterm elections in 2026. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Three hostages are free from Hamas captivity today. Relatives and friends cheered as they watched on television at the first sight of one of those released, American-Israeli Keith Siegel. In exchange, Israel freed 183 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. NPR's Daniel Estrin joins us from Tel Aviv. Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And you were there with some of Keith Siegel's family, I gather, watching as he was released.
It was a very emotional moment, Scott. I was in the living room of one of his extended relatives. There were neighbors and friends sitting in front of the TV and watching. They burst into cheers. They burst into tears. They watched Siegel emerge from a Hamas vehicle. He was wearing a baseball cap. He is originally from North Carolina, so this was a gathering of longtime American Jewish immigrants to Israel who've lived in Israel a long time, and they've been campaigning for his release for a very long time. And I met Siegel's brother's rabbi, Steve Bernstein, originally from Kansas City, who has been helping lead this community through this whole year plus. And I asked him what he's been feeling in this moment.
Joy, I don't have words. I think we've all gone through a crisis of faith, and we have, in the depths of despair, seen holiness in the sparks of the people around us, where we've been holding each other, and we have to keep that up.
And in Tel Aviv, there were hundreds of Israelis who gathered in a square. There was a big screen, and they whistled and clapped, watching every stage of the process as the three hostages were handed to the Red Cross and then to the Israeli military and then helicoptered across the border to Israel and reunited with their families.
Daniel, what was the scene like in Gaza when the release took place?
The release was orderly. There were two ceremonies. Hostages were handed over along with certificates and gift bags. These were surreal scenes that we've seen from other hostage releases over the last 2 weeks. Siegel was released near the Gaza port on the Mediterranean shoreline. Only recently, Israeli tanks had been there controlling movement. So symbolically, Hamas was putting on a display of strength and showing their unrivaled control in Gaza today. A Hamas militant leader was there who Israel had to admit today that they thought he had been killed during the war, but he survived. There was another development today. The Gaza-Egypt border crossing opened for the first time in many months, and 50 medical patients were able to leave to get treatment abroad.
And what's known about the Palestinians who were released by Israel today?
183 of them were released from Israeli jails. Most of them were detained in Gaza during the war. Some of them had been serving life sentences for deadly attacks against Israelis going back decades. There's one international case that got a lot of attention in recent years, a man who worked for the charity World Vision. Israel accused him of funding Hamas, and World Vision has been denying that for years. But NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, was there watching these families reunite with the prisoners and detainees released. He said it was a very overwhelming scene. There was celebratory gunfire. He saw a mother collapse, seeing her son after 2 decades in prison. And he saw one detainee return, and he collapsed when he saw no family come to greet him, and he was told the news that his immediate family had been killed during the war.
Daniel, President Trump hosts Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu next week at the White House. What's on the agenda?
Well, Trump wants to see the ceasefire hold. And many Israelis I met today say they hope Trump will press Israel not to return to the war to ensure that the many other hostages in Gaza are released. Trump has been talking about relocating Palestinians out of Gaza. We heard many Arab leaders today, foreign ministers, release a statement rejecting that. So there's a lot on the agenda, including possible moves toward a grand peace deal involving Saudi Arabia.
And there's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
President Trump has had a lot to say his first 2 weeks back in office, just as he floods the zone with executive orders and presidential memoranda. Trump is also filling the airwaves with presidential commentary on a wide range of topics. As NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports, the Trump show is back.
After a traumatic event, like the mid-air collision between a commercial airliner and an Army helicopter, the American people expect to see the president in the role of comforter-in-chief.
I'd like to request a moment of silence for the victims and their families, please.
But after the silence and a few sentences about a nation in anguish, President Trump veered sharply from the script presidents typically follow in a situation like this.
We do not know what led to this crash, but we have some very strong opinions and ideas, and I think we'll probably state those opinions now.
And state them he did, blaming the helicopter, air traffic control, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at the FAA, and Democrats. Later in the day, he summoned the press again.
Thank you very much for seeing me twice today. It's going to be quite an important signing, so we thought we'd let you watch.
It was just another day in the Trump presidency.
Meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Chris Whipple is the author of The Gatekeepers, a book about White House chiefs of staff. He says the fire hose of Trump content is all the more jarring because it follows 4 years of Biden.
They hid him. They had him hermetically sealed away for 4 years. We're now seeing the exact opposite of that with Trump, and it can be just as ineffective in its own way.
Matthew Seeger is a professor at Wayne State University and has spent his career studying the best ways to communicate in a crisis or disaster situation.
One of the fundamental characteristics of a crisis like this is uncertainty. What happened? Why? Who was involved? Are there going to be more events like this? What should we do? Those are the kinds of questions that people want answered.
Wildly speculating about possible causes doesn't help, Seeger says. It just risks injecting politics, division, and even more uncertainty. He says Trump has long been effective at harnessing the media spotlight. Remember the COVID briefings? Even in situations where it would be better if politicians hung back.
Disasters are always media events. So it is not surprising that he is taking advantage of these events as opportunities to demonstrate that he is in control.
During his first week in office, Trump visited North Carolina and Los Angeles to survey the damage from natural disasters that happened before he took office.
It is devastation. It's incredible. It's really an incineration. Even some of the chimneys came down, okay? When you have the chimneys come down, you know that's pretty hot stuff, and a lot of them were down. That was a bad sign, too.
Trump even mused that he might get rid of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or at least upend how it operates. He took questions from reporters six separate times in that single day. On the flight back east, Trump came to the press cabin on Air Force One.
You're getting a little bit more access to your president than you did the last time, slightly, like by about 5,000%.
Trump's TV programming approach to the presidency has changed the game, says Michael LaRosa, who was press secretary for First Lady Jill Biden.
The days of scripted, rehearsed, and practiced politicians are over.
And LaRosa says as long as Trump dominates the attention economy, at least on some level, he's winning.
The more you have him talking to reporters, the less room there will be in your stories and your reports from other voices who may have contradictory feelings or may challenge the premise of the president.
Political scientist Martha Joint Kumar, who tracks presidential interactions with journalists, says in his first 11 days, Trump did more Q&As with the press than in the entire first month of his first term. Trump is back and has even more to say. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
And now it's time for sports. The Super Bowl, 1 week away. Had you heard? And the WNBA expands. Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
You can smell the beignets in New Orleans right now.
Aw. Well, you've spent the last 2 weeks in Kansas City with the Chiefs, and some of us can smell the barbecue. Look, they have a league leader in Patrick Mahomes, a great coach in Andy Reid. Chiefs are just, you know, one win away from a third straight Super Bowl, but they had some close calls during the regular season. How do you motivate a team with players who may begin to ask, but how am I going to wear a third ring?
They had some close calls, but they emerged triumphant in nearly all of their games in the regular season. They only dropped, I think, two all season, despite winning a bunch of games by just one score. Now, Mahomes did tell me at the end of last season, Scott, that at some point he'll probably need a pinky championship ring because they are going for a third straight Super Bowl victory that's obviously never been reached in the Super Bowl era. And you would think that, you know, making that history would be amazingly motivating. But what I hear players actually talking about amongst themselves isn't a three-peat, but hey, let's go win a Super Bowl for the guys in this locker room who don't have one ring, much less three. There are a few ringless veterans, believe it or not, in the Kansas City Chiefs locker room, including 29-year-old Kareem Hunt and 32-year-old DeAndre Hopkins. You know, Hunt is on a second stint with the team. He missed their Super Bowl success. Hopkins was traded midseason. He's never been this far in the playoffs. And guys will say all the time, you know, let's get this for D-Hop, for example. Oh. You know, 29 and 32 are not old by any stretch of the imagination, but it's actually a little old in an NFL locker room, and they're really rallying around their elders, so to speak, on this Super Bowl run.
To ask you about an uglier turn of events in the NFL this week, Baltimore Ravens place kicker Justin Tucker is being accused of sexually inappropriate behavior. A story was broken by the Baltimore Banner, included accounts from six massage therapists. Justin Tucker denies the allegation. He calls them unequivocally false. What else do we know? How's the league reacting?
Gosh, what a story, Scott, for the Baltimore Banner. I think they started just a few years ago, and this is one of the biggest scandals to rock the NFL this season. It involves current Ravens kicker Justin Tucker. He is the most accurate kicker in NFL history. He was on the team when they won a Super Bowl in 2013. He's being accused, like you said, inappropriate sexual behavior. Some massage therapists refused to work with him, period. Two spas allegedly banned him from coming back, and all these claims, Scott, stem from a period between 2012 and 2016. League spokesman said they're taking this seriously. They're looking into the matter. And that sounds kind of rote, but it's very serious. He could be subject to the league's personal conduct policy, like Deshaun Watson was, and could be subject to a very long suspension. A lot of people are talking about whether or not Tucker decides just to retire after this.
WNBA is expanding. Going to be new teams in San Francisco, Portland, and Toronto in the next two seasons. Then a franchise in a yet-to-be-named city by 2028. Their ownership groups contending in Detroit, Nashville, Philadelphia. Nashville's got an interesting proposal for a name, doesn't it?
Yeah, interesting to say the least. I think it's really cool. In Nashville's bid for a WNBA team, they say they would call the team, if they do get granted an expansion franchise, they would call the team the Tennessee Summit in honor of the late Pat Summit, of course, the legendary coach of the Lady Vols for 38 years. She died. I couldn't believe how long it's been. She died in 2016 after battling early onset dementia. Yeah. And one of Summit's former players, Candace Parker, is actually part of this prospective ownership group. And she was so close to Coach Summit. And she said that Summit was so impactful on her life, made her the best version of herself, and she's honored to be part of the Tennessee Summit ownership group.
Ah, That's so nice.
Yeah, pretty neat.
Michelle Steele, covers sports for ESPN. Thanks so much for being with us.
You bet, Scott.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. An air ambulance crashed in Philadelphia last night shortly after takeoff. The four crew members and a patient and her mother all died. The plane exploded upon impact, causing at least one nearby house to catch fire. Kenny Cooper of member station WHYY joins us. Kenny, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Take us through what happened. What do we know?
Well, sometime after 6 p.m. on Friday, a Learjet 55 that was carrying six people crashed in Northeast Philadelphia. It unleashed this huge explosion and started a fire. And the jet rescue air ambulance was supposed to be traveling from Philadelphia to Missouri and then eventually in its final destination in Mexico. And as you mentioned earlier, there was a pediatric patient on board who was accompanied by her mother and four crew members, and all six were unfortunately killed in the crash. Some videos online show like the jet falling from the sky and then like blowing up. And witnesses that I spoke to were at a loss for words. I spoke to a guy by the name of Vadim Asipov, who was originally from Ukraine, but currently lives in the Philly area. He told me he was in shock, and we were standing outside in the rain, and he's just huddling, watching the scene kind of unfold.
And what was that scene like, the explosion on the ground as much as anything else?
So this area is like a mixture of commercial spaces as well as homes. And there was obviously a very large and intense fire. There was smoke. A handful of people on the ground were injured. At least six people were admitted into Temple University Hospital Jean's campus with injuries. And the explosion kind of set off this blaze that was, you know, caught onto a house, and there was debris and items from the crash spread out all around the scene, and people ran out into the streets. And as I mentioned before, it was also raining. So, you know, people are just soaked, huddling in the rain, trying to look and see what was going on.
How has the city responded?
You know, people couldn't believe what they were seeing. And, you know, as the city kind of rushed to the scene, I'm talking police, fire, they begin sectioning off the street so people can get access to it. And they immediately went to go fight the blaze. There were state officials on the scene, you know, Pennsylvania State Police, Department of Transportation, Emergency Management Authority, even Department of Environmental Protection. You know, they were all kind of mobilized to help manage the site. Then Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker spoke to the media and alongside Governor Josh Shapiro and basically kind of, you know, reaffirm this message of One Philly, which is something they've been saying recently about uniting the city under one message, right? And that's kind of been their response, is asking people to kind of rally around to each other and make sure they avoid the scene but support one another.
Kenny, any indications that you can report on so far as to why this flight may have crashed?
No, we do not have any official confirmation of anything yet. Governor Josh Shapiro said that he was in contact by phone with the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, Sean Duffy, who dispatched four FAA personnel to the area. So we're going to wait for this National Transportation Safety Board to lead the investigation. But as of now, you know, a lot of it's just speculation.
Kenny Cooper of member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Kenny, thank you so much for being on The Story and being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
The Grammy Awards Sunday will spotlight not just one or two new stars, but an entire new generation of pop divas.
If you told me at the same time last year that all of these people would be some of the biggest names in pop music and on the Grammy stage tonight, I wouldn't have believed you.
Tune in for a preview of music's biggest night and performances. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. You can't sleep.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Israeli-American Keith Siegel was released today after being held by Hamas in Gaza since October of 2023. He was among three hostages released under the terms of a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. New trade penalties are to go into effect today against Canada, Mexico, and China. President Trump plans to impose a 25% tariff against imports from Canada and Mexico and 10% on goods from China. This is likely to raise prices for U.S. consumers. And a medical transport plane crashed while taking off in Philadelphia last night. Six people aboard the plane were killed. The mayor says one person on the ground was killed and 19 injured. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Brian and their sister Rose are unverifiables. Red line is painted around their house after their mother leaves on a family emergency. But they find a place in which to squat, where the horses that graze in an adjacent field lift their eyes and hearts to someplace else. Glyph is the name they give a horse and is the title of a new novel from Ali Smith, the novelist and playwright. Won the Orwell Prize for Political Fiction for her novel Summer, and she is sometimes called Scotland's Nobel Laureate in Waiting.
Oh, don't say that.
Thanks so much for being with us.
It's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Scott.
Who are and what are the unverifiables in this society?
Oh, in the society in the book, people like these two kids who are like 11 and 13, who come home and find that something or someone is painted around their house, a red paint line. They have no idea what it means, but the chap who's looking after them, that's their mother's partner, gathers them up, loads them into their camper van. They drive off to think, well, what will we do next? And they park in one of those supermarket car parks, 24-hour supermarket. And when they wake up in the morning, there's a red painted line round their van, and they find that they are now designated unverifiable.
Unverifiable meaning devices and data can't ID them?
Unverifiable meaning that they're unverifiable. They're called the UVs, the unverifiables, and these kids they're not very tech savvy. Their mother has kept them away from tech for much of their lives against their will, especially Bri, the older of the kids, who loves tech and wants to use it. But their mother has decided that they should use books and dictionaries and try and look things up, not just on a screen.
In this society in which your characters live and we accompany them, there are no libraries. The environment seems to be falling apart. Somebody, someone seems to know everything. Do people take that for granted? Are they kind of reconciled to what we see as authoritarianism?
Oh, hey. Well, this is a book about exactly that. There's been an incredible loss of libraries in the UK. I don't know. I presume it's the same in the US, that there's a fading away of a library culture. People have decided that information is what libraries are for, if anything. Information, it's not the same as knowledge. And the thing about libraries was that knowledge was at any single person in the world's fingertips as soon as they entered a library. And it was free. And it was for everyone. And it was that democratically open.
But I mean, that's what the internet's supposed to be too, isn't it?
So yeah, the internet is a great source of information until there's the information that it doesn't have on it, that you go to look for and it isn't there. And what control do we have over that? And plus, you know, the difference between information and knowledge is the difference between an ice covering across a really deep loch and the depth of that loch. That's the difference between knowing information and having knowledge. It is dimensional. And my God, as human beings, we need dimension. We are dimensional and we live by our dimensionality rather than the things which suggest to us that we are simply surface.
one point we turned the page and you hit us with the words, Brave New World. Authoritarian states always come in with the promise that they will make life brighter and better, don't they?
Oh, that's the lovely thing about authority, isn't it? Doesn't it feel like someone's in charge? It's very attractive, authoritarianism. It seems safe. It seems like, yeah, that's it. There's a code. There's a way to live, and that's the way, and we go with that leader until that authority doesn't suit the life that many people or some people or anyone would like to live. Then you're up against authority. Authoritarianism.
I, of course, mentioned the, that big literary prize of which you are often spoken about. But I also see you were once an advertising copywriter.
I was. How did you find that out?
From the internet.
From the internet. See what I mean?
Do you remember any lines from ads that you wrote?
I so do. My brother, in his earlier incarnation in his life, he ran an advertising company. He started working in advertising and eventually had his own company. And he asked me to do some work for him repeatedly. So I wrote copy for Scottish banks, and I wrote copy for Paterson Bronte biscuits. I wrote little poems for them. The poem for, I think it was November, ran, "The autumn leaves are falling fast, the winter's almost back. Buy Paterson Bronte Golden Crunch, the perfect fireside snack."
I'm deeply moved.
Oh, you see the effect advertising has on us? You know what the word slogan is a version of a Scottish Gaelic word. Do you know what it means?
No.
It's connected to the English word slughorn, because it comes from a Gaelic word that sounds more like sluggern. And sluggern and slughorn meant a war cry.
Mm.
So slogans are directly descended from warfare and war cries, the noise that one tribe makes when it's facing another and it blows its horn going, da-da! Buy Paterson Bronte Golden Crunch, the perfect fireside snack, da-da! Almost everything about slogans can be connected to the tribal in us, which is why they work so well in us.
Yeah. Do you find people read your books, and including, of course, notably this one, Glyph, because they want a view of the future or a view of the future they want to avoid?
I honestly don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I know I read books because I love reading. Fiction in particular, there is a kind of truth that can't be said any other way. I think it finds a way to say the things which are either inarticulable or being stopped from being said or are very, very, very difficult to articulate. I love that about fiction. It is ever, ever hopeful, regardless of its sometimes very dark subject matter.
Ali Smith, your new novel, Glyph. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott, and what a pleasure to talk to you.
Here's a sobering thought.
Even in a healthy environment, anything that sets us off our path toward eternal happiness could cause us stress.
Oh, mercy. That's science educator Kate Bieberdorf, otherwise known as Kate the Chemist. She hosts the Seeking a Scientist podcast on member station KCUR in Kansas City. Later today in All Things Considered, she explores why stress is so challenging for scientists to study. It sounds so stressful. You can listen by telling your smart speaker to play your member station by name. The first British band to command the stage at Harlem's famed Apollo Theater wasn't the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. It was Samande.
Sometimes I wonder if it's all been in vain. It seems nothing matters.
Born by Steve Scipio and Patrick Patterson in 1971, the group toured with towering figures, including Al Green. They appeared on Soul Train, and then they broke up, only to find themselves sampled years later by Grandmaster Flash, De La Soul, the Fugees, and more.
Is it real? What they feel?
And now Samande is back. Founder Steve Scipio and Patrick Patterson join us from the BBC in London. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
And what brings you back?
I don't think we ever really went away. We took a short break, short hiatus, to do other things because coming home, we didn't find the sort of reception that we needed or the future that we were looking for. So we came off the road to take a long look at what we want to do in the future. And a few years ago, we decided to just make sure that everybody was ready, and they were, including the producer, John Schroeder, and the engineer, Alan Florence, and the original membership. And we cut a new record, or we started the process for cutting a new record.
You both left the UK and became lawyers in the Caribbean, right?
Lawyers in the UK.
Yeah, we were lawyers in the UK, but we went to the to the Caribbean. Yeah.
You know, I've got to tell you, I think I've met a lot of lawyers who'd like to be big music stars, but never the other way around. What were you thinking?
It's backward thinking, actually.
How do you think your music has changed since the 70s?
We're hoping it hasn't changed too much. I mean, it was a difficult process for us getting to this point of the production of the album, because the people are more familiar, obviously, with the three albums that we did in the 70s. But it's a long time that has passed. You know, it's 40, 50 years since then. And we didn't want to be coming back now and trying to recreate something that had happened, you know, in the 70s, when we were different people, because we are now vastly different in terms of our life experiences. But at the same time, in doing this album, we still wanted it to be recognizably Simande, so that people could hear this and say, yes, I can see the connections with the album of the past, although there are some little differences in terms of, you know, like instrumentation, for example. We now utilizing keyboards. Thought she must be crazy or just mistaken. It's playing with my mind. And I'm trying to read between the lines. Dancing my head like a raging storm. We wanted to have the space, that kind of atmospheric kind of thing that we had with the first three albums. We wanted to have that with this album. And we feel that although all that time has passed, that there's still a connectedness between the Simande of the 70s and the Simande of today.
And we've tried to maintain originality and quality.
Let me follow up a bit, because this is an album that includes funk and reggae, but also jazz. Let's listen a little to the track Coltrane. What inspires you in the music and the life of John Coltrane?
It's a metaphor for the quality of music that we want to achieve and that is produced in our community and by our people. Coltrane himself is such a towering figure. It's in all our lives as musicians. He's in all our lives as musicians. But it's not just about his artistry. It's about what is demanded of others as musicians. Every new beginning. Whether he had said a word or not, whether he had blown a note or not, what he represents is a mountain for people of our generation, people of our background, not just musicians, individuals as well.
Let me ask you about another cut. The Road to Zion.
Wanna be a face in a crowd of faces. I wanna be a man with no name.
It's a beautiful song.
Thank you.
How do you want us to hear it? What's it about?
It's about redemption. You know, I think what we articulate in this track is something that all individuals feel. Either that you screwed up, or if even you haven't screwed up, you need to put something properly on track, undo things that you have done in the past that you aren't proud of, get a bit of forgiveness that you really wish you could get. Sometimes you can't, because that which you have done and the persons you have done it to have gone.
I guess we could all use a little of that as we age.
We all need it.
Definitely.
We all need it. On the road to Zion. On the road to Zion.
Yeah. Is music fun for you? Gratifying? More than ever?
Music is creatively and artistically very fulfilling, and has been the food for us, and it has remained that way.
Music is life fulfilling. Patrick and I started playing together and learning its instruments and so on since our early teens, and it's been with us ever since.
That's Steve Scipio and Patrick Patterson of Simonde. Their new album is called Renaissance. And gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was very, very, very nice speaking to you as well.
I wonder why we play this game. We keep going on while things remain.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
We keep rolling on.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. This is NPR.